From Social Service ISG, I am Jing Yao. Using two child cohorts, Dr. Jonathan Huang and his team at the Singapore Institute for Clinical Sciences at the Agency for Science, Technology and Research sought to understand lifestyle changes experienced by Singaporean children after the country's circuit breaker, as well as the potential long-term outcomes. In our conversation, we learn more about the research findings and methodology, future directions, and the potential practice and policy implications. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Huang. Could you, maybe first tell us a little bit about yourself and the research and work that you do at the Singapore Institute for Clinical Studies at the Agency for Science, Technology and Research, more popularly known as ASTAR?
Yes, thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate your podcast. So I'll start with a brief description of the Singapore Institute for Clinical Studies, or SICS for short. So as you said, SICS is a research institute under ASTAR, under the ministry. Its mission is to promote health and human capacity in Singapore, Asia, the region, and globally. And our research really strives to help Singaporeans get the best start to life and be well-positioned to develop to their full potential, whatever that means, throughout their lives. And we do this through highly multidisciplinary research on early child physical, mental, social, emotional development, taking a life course approach. And importantly, we want to focus on research that will get towards interventions or policy change. So SICS partners with both international research organizations and networks that share similar goals, and also very importantly, local stakeholders, and in particular, government ministries, the civil service, and the research arms of those ministries. So within SICS, there are a number of different PIs and research groups, and they have a number of independent researches projects that revolve around the theme of early childhood health and human potential. But our major research activities have revolved around several large cohort studies, and we'll talk about cohort studies later. But these cohort studies of Singaporean families that we've shepherded in collaboration with KK Women's and Children's Hospital and National University Hospital. In particular, we're talking about today research that comes from two cohorts, Gusto and Espresto. And these two cohorts represent really some of the most in-depth long-term studies on early child physical and mental health and development really in the world. And as you can imagine, given the amount of data that we routinely collect and have collected for close to 13 years now, this is really a large time and resource intensive commitment, particularly on the part of families, and to continue participating in our studies every year. So we really do owe both our research staff and these committed families participating in our studies a really great debt of gratitude. And we have a really large responsibility to do right by them. In any case, we have a multidisciplinary team of researchers, as I said, from obstetricians and pediatricians to neuroscientists, nutritional experts, physical activity experts, you name it. We've been following up hundreds of Singaporean families, and we recruit these families to our cohort studies from right when they get pregnant, or in the case of Espresto, just before they get pregnant, and following them up over time with periodic visits. Generally, they become annual visits. And now the kids, as I said, are as old as 12 years of age, and they're going to be going on to 13, going on to PSLE years. So my own role as a principal investigator within SICS centers around a few things. Broadly speaking, I'm interested in the specific biological, social, behavioral pathways that lead to differences in child and life course health, and more specifically, the research methods and how we actually do research to understand and tease apart those pathways. As you know, and I'm sure talked about, one's health is a product of a number of different factors: environmental, social, familial, personal, biological, and really teasing them apart is quite a challenge. At the same time, it's really important to be able to do those things if we want to be able to answer the question of how to intervene or what policies to inform or to suggest or to recommend. And to give a general example, right, we know that parental weight status is related to child's weight status and the child's own metabolic health. And this is something that we're interested in, with child obesity and diabetes, a big concern for us, both here and globally. We need to understand, what's this relationship? Is this due to biological processes that happen during pregnancy, how children are fed, physical activity that involves families, right? So a lot of times that participate in play and those kinds of things involve families. Are there social factors such as stigma or stressful environments that change how we behave or any combination thereof, it's likely a combination of all of those, right? And because of disciplinary divides, we often tend to think of these things sort of separately, you know, biological here, social here, environmental here, even though we know that they're all at work in any person, family, or community. I think really the upshot, the encouraging news is that there's really been substantial sort of multidisciplinary advances, both in the scientific method, in technology to be able to measure different things, and statistical methods to help us tease that apart. And so my work involves adapting, applying, and consulting on using these approaches to a lot of the research that's done. I have specific research projects looking at environmental pollutants, role of genetics and epigenetics, and actually just a new project that we're starting to launch looking at the really under-examined roles of dads and partners in the health of Singaporean children. I bring with me sort of experience, sort of habits I've picked up with working with data and managing cohorts from a number of settings, from US to Canada. I've worked with a cohort study in Jerusalem, in Israel, South Africa, now Singapore.
And from that large body of work in the institute and from your own research, right, we're going to focus on one of the people, from the many you have, we're going to focus on one. And here's what I understand from that paper, which we will introduce in the beginning and which we'll also link in the show notes, right? So you and your colleagues, you studied the lifestyle changes experienced by parents and children months after the end of the 2020 circuit breaker in Singapore, right? So what you found was that about a third of the children in your sample still reported no outdoor play months after the circuit breaker. And in turn, eliminating all outdoor activity was related to increases in the body mass index or BMI of primary school age children. So maybe let's break this study down. To start, could you help us understand the concerns associated with non-existent or insufficient outdoor play for children? And of course, in turn, what are some of the concerns linked to BMI increases and childhood obesity?
Yeah, so I think you asked this question in a very good way, because I think you are right to separate the concerns about lack of outdoor play for one and BMI increases for another. And I'll try to answer this and actually answer this in reverse order, because I'm just going to sort of figure out why. So for the BMI findings or the BMI increases that we saw, to clarify really what we saw was we, of course, expect weight gain in children, right, in growing children. But what we saw was that those kids who stopped all outdoor play between the times of the start of the circuit breaker to just afterwards, they reported basically no outdoor play anymore. Those children gained substantially more weight than sort of expected, than what the other children in the study had experienced. Those children who are still spending or reported spending at any time outdoors. And to give a little bit of a clarification for people who may be not familiar with BMI, though I would imagine that most people are, it's a bit like a weight density measure. So it's the total amount of weight in kgs divided by the height squared. So really, if kids gain weight faster, then they're getting taller because they get taller at the same time. This can be due to either increasing muscle mass or fat mass. And in either case, if they gain more weight than their height, their BMI will go up. So for reference, the average for the school-age children, and we really saw this gain more in the school-age children than in preschool-age children, on average, the children gained about 1.5 units of BMI between study visits. So between 2020 and 2021, actually between 2019 and 2021, that was basically what was expected. And children who were eliminated all outdoor play following the circuit breaker had a further 0.5 units or a 33% increase over and above this. And we're generally concerned with this because higher adiposity that may be reflected by BMI prior to puberty could be related to a higher risk of developing chronic conditions in adulthood, including diabetes, cardiovascular disease. And certainly we're going to continue to follow up on this signal to see, you know, what's going on with these children. Do these things persist? You know, now that we're going on 3 years on, do we see the same kind of trends? Do we see different trends in these or other kids? But I think that being said, I return to the sort of first part, which was the lack of outdoor play, because I think that what we're most concerned of was that we saw any signal at all, you know, 1 year on from the circuit breaker, right? Even though in mid-2021, where we're following up these kids again, life is not back to normal. I don't think we'll ever say that life will be, you know, post-COVID. But we had very few movement restrictions. Kids were back at school. We would anticipate that kids would be doing sort of the same activities they were doing before. So why should we continue to see a signal that far removed from time? And it was a substantial percentage, you know, a third of the school-age children reporting absolutely no outdoor play. Whereas prior to the circuit breaker, it was very few children. I mean, children spend some time outdoors. So I think that that particular signal really gives us pause to think about what's going on, what is or isn't returning to normal, you know, during this phase, or are there temporary things that occur that have persistent effects over time, which we wouldn't anticipate that there could be. And so the other thing that we think about is also, if this was specifically about returning to outdoor play, there's not any reason, right, that kids would not, after the circuit breaker, you know, right, get right back out there and start playing again. And in fact, you know, even during the circuit breaker, the rules were you were allowed to go outside for exercise. So there's nothing really physically, there's no rules physically stopping kids from doing it. So it's really an indicator here. We're seeing this signal of potentially greater or lasting changes to kids' usual pattern of activities. Right? And I think that that's the bigger message and that's the bigger question. So it encourages us to think about what other disruptions have occurred, for whom have they occurred, and if and when, you know, we see them, are there long-term health and developmental consequences? So I'll give another example from the study. We saw a fair number of parents, around a quarter of them, one in four, reporting, then this was just after the circuit breaker, that kids didn't want to go outside anymore, full stop. Not just play outdoors, but they didn't want to go shopping or going to the market either. And I don't have an explanation for this. We just sort of, you know, in our study, we've described a number of different changes. I think it's up to further research to really figure out, tease apart what's going on. But I think an underlying driver of these behaviors, I mean, it might be quite obvious to say, is actually the real or perceived risks of COVID-19 that people had at that point in time and may still have now. And that varies across family and family circumstances. And so it's not specifically related to, you know, the circuit breaker rules or any rules that we have going on per se, but it's actually some perceived risk that, that leads to continued behavior change. And so we really need to understand sort of what underlies these changes in behaviors, whether or not they'll go away. And I think that, you know, that that sort of discussion point about behavior change and risk perception, you know, that's not exclusive to COVID, right? So that's something that is something that we understand we need to be studying in the months and years ahead, you know, COVID aside. So I think to restate, cessation of outdoor play was an indicator, really, maybe a tip of the iceberg for us to consider what sort of lasting changes in behaviors have occurred. And I think a lot more work needs to be done to investigate this, and in particular, you know, interdisciplinary work, working across different silos to try to understand it.
Yeah, and there's something you mentioned earlier about interdisciplinary work, and you made reference earlier to your team using two ongoing population-based prospective child cohorts, which I think listeners will be interested to find out more, right? So, which basically means, correct me if I'm wrong, there were two groups of children who have been tracked since they were born. And I'll just help out the listeners here because you mentioned ESPRESTO, which stands for the Singapore Preconception Study of Long-Term Maternal and Child Outcomes. So ESPRESTO is a cohort of preschool children who are about 1 to 4.5 years old. That's one group. Then the other group is GUSTO, right, which is growing up in Singapore towards healthy outcomes. These are primary school children, 9 to about 10.7 years old, right? So maybe help us understand the research methodology. Could you explain the value of using these population-based cohort studies in epidemiology and how your team was able, I think this is for my own curiosity, how your team was able to survey the families at the point in time, at the moment of the circuit breaker back in 2020?
Yeah, thank you. And really, it is a key sort of strength of this research and this type of research over, I think, a lot of, you know, and not to sort of celebrate it too much, a lot of other research that's been coming out around COVID-19. And so you're right to point it out. Without too much technical detail, the cohorts are what we call population-based, meaning that we tried as much to sample a broad base of families as they might appear in the community. Obviously, it's voluntary. So there's still some people who decide to participate in it, but generally you try to get people from sort of all walks of life to be sort of representative of Singapore as a whole. And we recruit these participants, as you sort of helpfully described for GUSTO, by looking at expectant mothers early in pregnancy, and they were invited to join around 2009 to 2010. And we've been following, since the time they joined, we've been following them up over time. So very intensely, actually, in the first year or two of life. And then annually since then, kids are about 12 years. We're about to start 13 years visits soon. So for ESPRESTO, it's quite similar, except we were interested in actually the fertility and very early pregnancy or preconception part of it. So we enrolled couples who were trying to get pregnant and then followed them until they got pregnant. And then again, similarly, so on until as old as 5 years. And so a major benefit of this, of course, is that you're following the same people over time, and we can measure all sorts of different things. And we have measured all sorts of different things, from genetics to microbiome, brain and body MRI. We've tracked their physical activity, diet, and eating behaviors. We've done clinical studies of their cognitive emotional development in the children, and we're able to measure these things repeatedly over time to get a real sense of how these things evolve over time. And that's really the gold standard of studying child development, understanding how children grow and change over time. Not only do you get sort of a broad picture, because we try to recruit from the population of sort of total landscape of children's experiences, but then you're also able to link those changes over time within each individual. And this is really critical because, you know, we know from both sort of the social and medical domains of research that there are critical periods of development for child development. And so we want to be able to, for a child, you know, link up those critical periods to things that have come before, to things that will come afterwards, and have this temporal sequence. And we're able to look at this at a very granular level, deep down to the molecular level. So I'll contrast that with other types of studies, such as doing censuses that people might be familiar with, or repeated surveys. Now, they may be able to get large samples because they're sort of easier to do, you know, send out a broad survey to everyone, and they can tell you about general trends over time, right? So you can say that in 2020, this was what the population looked at, like in 2022, this is what the population looked at, but it doesn't get at the depth, for one, and it isn't able to link up within people in that study, you know, link up different measures within people in that study. And I'll come back to that point. Right? So then your second question about, you know, how were we able to get this out in time? And if you've done any research before, you know that it can be quite a challenge to be flexible to sort of change research streams midstream. This is a large endeavor, obviously, and this is not something that we plan to do. But as I said, you know, we really have a big responsibility to the participants in our study. They keep coming back year over year, and they do all of these things. So we were really concerned, you know, when COVID-19 happened and it really changed everybody's lives in early 2020, we wanted to see how our families were doing. We had to pause the visits, obviously, but we needed some way to reach out. So in April and May of that time, we had developed and put out some information, links to resources, including, you know, government support programs that might be used to the families in our study to weather sort of the early days of the pandemic. Well, now we know it's the early days. In the meantime, as we were doing this, we were also thinking we'd like to sort of get more in depth about collecting information. So a team of us, including some pediatricians, some social scientists, child development specialists, we sort of put our heads together and put together a short survey that sort of we would try to get bang for our buck, right? To make it as short as possible, but to capture as much of changes that have occurred in and around the time of COVID that would give us a gauge about how our families were faring, what challenges they were facing during this period. Again, asking a few questions, but with those few questions, trying to capture as much as possible. And then also focusing not too much on the disease itself, because, you know, at that time, if you remember, you know, our community cases were very low. That really wasn't sort of the main focus at that time. But at the same time, we were interested in these life changes. And we were interested not only in the perspective of the parents, but also of the children themselves. So for the school-aged children that were able to answer these web questionnaires, so the Gusto cohort, we also asked them to fill out these. And to their credit, basically every parent that, you know, every parent that did complete this, their kids also completed it. So it worked out.
Yeah.
And we asked things related to employment, receipt of the government assistance. There was a number of government assistance programs that came out. We asked them about their own personal changes in diet and physical activity, really reasoning that long-term outcomes that we would be interested in, we could then revisit when the official visits picked up again. You know, we have all this infrastructure to collect a lot of good data around this time. We can leverage that data and all the expertise that's going into producing those outcome measures against these sort of exposure or changes that were happening during COVID. And that's really our intention. We were able, thankfully, to get the survey finalized, approved through ethics, jump through all the hoops to get everybody sort of on board. And a lot of credit to the IRB, which was very good at, you know, turning these things around. One of the tricky things that I'll say, I think for maybe people who aren't as familiar with with sort of research design is we had this challenge in developing the questionnaire that we had to take into consider sort of all possible potential avenues. So when we ask a question, you know, do you do these kinds of things or how has this sort of change affected you? We had to sort of time it so that, you know, if there were any, you know, if there were ongoing restrictions, for example, then there would be no point in asking a certain question about that particular activity, right? And it was a bit of a balancing act, but we managed to get it done. And fortunately, actually, the timing was just so that we were able to capture both the pre and post pandemic events with our survey. So I just want to go back quickly to the what I mentioned earlier about the benefits of the cohort study, right? Is that we were then, with that one survey, that slice in time, able to link that to the individual's data, you know, from the years previous, from 2019 previously, through, you know, early childhood. And now we are able to then link those responses onward. And that's not something that you can't do with sort of just the point in time survey. And, you know, another beneficial scientific aspect of that is that we can ask a bunch of questions here during the COVID-19 survey, but then sort of objective measures of the different kinds of growth measures or MRI or other instruments were done separately. So if they have biases, they're sort of independent, right? So that's a good feature of that design.
And I should quickly mention for the listener, because you mentioned the IRB, which is the Institutional Review Board. So for folks who are researching human subjects, that's usually the board that gives the approval and makes sure that the risks and benefits are clearly explained to the participants and so on and so forth. So this is for folks who are listening and wanting to find out more. We've been talking a lot about the methodology, and I wanted to kind of come back to your key finding about outdoor play and exercise, right? So the average or mean age of your preschool age children was about 2.6 years. This is the Espresso cohort. And then the primary school age children, they were about 9.9 years old. This is the Gusto kids. It was found from the article, and I quote, "Seizing outdoor play or exercise was more frequently reported by parents of older children than by those with younger children." So basically, those who were older had less outdoor exercise and outdoor play, right? So what accounts for the difference in this study?
Yeah, thanks for highlighting this. I think one of the things that we were particularly interested in, and luckily our two cohorts allowed us to do this, was to see if the disruptions due to COVID-19 played out differently for children at different developmental ages. And this really helps us ask a question of really what dynamics are at work, what sort of factors are important to children at different ages, how disruptive are these changes are to different family compositions, right? Families with older kids or families with younger kids. So obviously, I mean, first and foremost, the ability for children to understand and adapt to changes in daily life do vary. And I think anyone who has kids can sort of attest that it may be more or less challenging depending on whether or not you have younger kids, babies or toddlers or older children or adolescents, teenagers, so on and so forth. And so if they're, you know, toddlers are primary age, their developmental needs are going to differ. And I think their physical activity needs would differ as well. I think we're just starting to scratch the surface of trying to understand this, I mean, within our cohorts of this differential susceptibility. But I suppose that one obvious answer for why we didn't necessarily see a difference in toddlers is that if indeed this was due to changes in play, I think toddlers are much more easier to adapt to play in an indoor setting because, you know, they're smaller, they need less room. And the kind of activities that they typically do, running and tumbling, you can do that indoors, you can do that on furniture, that sort of thing. Whereas if we're thinking about primary age kids, their main activity may come from co-curriculars, it came from organized sports, team sports, outdoor activities, and those may potentially be more greatly affected. And we had done actually some short interviews with just a few parents, following up on these changes and asking them sort of a little bit more, diving a little bit more into their physical activities. And we did see that parents expressed sort of varying abilities to cope with these pandemic-related changes, whether it's child support and activities. I think some were able to cope very well. Let's say the kid participates in, you know, solo sports or participates in things that don't require a lot of space or they have sort of avenues to be able to continue that sport. and others having great difficulties reporting some of the things that we found in our study, that the kids didn't want to go outside, or it was difficult to get them to go outside. The typical play that they were engaging in, let's say in the play areas, they weren't doing anymore. So I think, again, the work ahead is to understand where these differences lie.
Yep.
And if the barriers are different between older kids or younger kids, or between different kinds of families, and to address those barriers that are related to these disruptions.
And we'll get to the future directions in the final question, but another finding from the study which caught my attention was the finding that, in relation to household income, and I quote from the study and the article, that those families with lower pre-lockdown household income were more likely to report substantial changes in financial status and elimination of outdoor play or exercise for their children. So what do we know about the reasons or potential explanations for the difference in relation to household income?
Yeah, so I think to give some specific, give that context a bit of finding in the, sorry, to give some specific context for that finding, right? We found that those reported lower pre-pandemic household income were more likely to report ceasing any outdoor play or physical activity than those with higher incomes. And that this change was along basically the entire spectrum. It wasn't restricted specifically to low-income families per se, right? The increased risk of ceasing outdoor play was sort of across all segments of society, with the families of moderate pre-pandemic household incomes more likely to report reduce outdoor play as opposed to those with highest income, and sort of so on and so forth down the scale. And we haven't yet looked deeper into the source of this observed relationship in our study. Certainly it'll be a goal for further research. However, I think it doesn't take too much to sort of give some potential reasons, given what we know both it's in Singapore and has been reported globally, that there are a lot of pandemic-related causes that could have contributed to this difference and to this association. We know that there are differences across the spectrum in flexibility working arrangements that allow parents to take kids out to play, to accompany child play, differences in accessibility of alternative play or sport activities, and different arrangements in being able to take kids out to play. Again, focusing just on potential differences in play itself. And as I mentioned before, the play is an indicator for other disruptions that we will be looking at, but aren't really mentioning here. I think also there are real and perceived differences in the risks of contracting COVID-19 or passing them along to family members. There are perceptions and I think realities in terms of sort of the consequences of contracting COVID-19 or the consequences of family members contracting COVID-19. And this differs, across the spectrum. It differs across different segments of the population. And it's certainly something that we should be looking more into, whether or not these things have ongoing and long-term health and developmental consequences for the kids.
And as a final question, that's a kind of good segue, because as a final question with an eye on the future, right? It was also mentioned in the Straits Times report that your team will be looking into the factors which may influence other child outcomes in your cohort, right? So the factors that were cited could include employment changes, family life, screen and online time, exposure to and experiences with COVID-19, and financial assistance, right? Given that a lot of the listeners are kind of practitioners, right? They're listening, they're reading your journal article. Now, how is the team planning to use some of these findings in terms of kind of potential practice and policy implications that folks on the ground could potentially use and make sense of down the road?
Yeah, thanks. I think there's two questions there, sort of like, what is the longer term research ambitions? And then how are those ambitions translated to any practice or policy changes? And, yep. And I'll sort of reiterate that is, I'm happy to be answering this question, because this is something that we're thinking about sort of constantly when we're trying to do more research is, how can we put this to use? I'll reiterate again, I think, the story of COVID-19, and this is, I think, something that you've said and something that's come out a lot is one of disruption. So, some people disrupted more, some people disrupted less. I think our studies here are uniquely situated to sort of ask and try to answer that question about who, why, and to what extent that's happening, specifically for our Singaporean context, given the data that we've collected today, we're planning to collect. But I think in other respects, the disruptions due to COVID are really just sort of a pointed, widely experienced example of challenges parents and children face every day that have bearing on their health and development. So we have different expert teams that really have already been looking into these issues, you know, COVID aside, right? Outside of this context. So for example, we had a team of physical activity experts that have been using accelerometers to track kids' physical activity and link them to different environments, different parenting styles. So all this sort of feed together into sort of presenting a more holistic picture of what's going on, what are the different disruptions, COVID being one of them, and then other ones as well, and to provide sort of context and again, potential avenues for interventions, right? Then how will we sort of turn these things into policy or practice? As I mentioned before, we have these really great ongoing collaborations with the ministries and their research entities. And so we do a lot of sharing of data, research findings, and there are some ongoing projects now, but also we're always sort of in the process of thinking about how to co-develop both the practice and policy relevant research agenda, as well as potential interventions or changes that may arise from them. So it's this interaction that makes it happen. Another thing that sort of helps us leverage this is that there was a newly launched center at NUS, the Center for Holistic Initiatives for Learning and Development. And their specific goal is to take some of the research findings from our studies and from other studies and think about the translational science elements. You know, what are the things that turn some interesting findings into things that are practical, scalable, et cetera, in order to benefit children across Singapore. So I think a lot of things are to come.
And we'll be looking out for it. And you know, with that, thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule for helping us make sense. It's not always to get a deep dive into the methodology, get an understanding of it and the findings. And we'll be sure listeners will be looking out for future kind of implications and studies as well. So thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.